City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, invisible aircraft, robots at war with cyber war columnist Charles R. Smith. Here's some of the quick stories of the day, then we'll get right into our top story. Of course, as you know, for the past several weeks now, I've been saying that in this intuitiveness, I feel that there's something strange afoot here, and it just looks like the scenario is being painted for something big on this planet. Here are just a few of the stories. You connect the dots. It's only a matter of time before Al-Qaeda or another terrorist group tries to launch an attack on the United States with chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons, according to the CIA director, Porter Goss. He told a Senate panel this. Al-Qaeda, he says, is trying very hard to circumvent U.S. security and launch an attack on U.S. soil, adding that they are getting their training on the urban battlefields in Iraq. Islamic extremists are exploiting the Iraqi conflict to recruit new anti-U.S. jihadists, he told a Senate Intelligence Committee. Those jihadists who survive will leave Iraq experienced in and focused on acts of urban terrorism. They represent a potential pool of contacts to build transnational terrorist cells, groups, and networks in Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and other countries. Israel is saying that Iran is just 6 months away now from being able to build its own atomic bomb. Meanwhile, an Iranian state television rattled the world by reporting earlier today an explosion near Iran's only nuclear power plant. A senior Iranian military officer later said the explosion in southern Iran, initially reported as caused by a missile, was indeed blasting work during the construction of a dam. But the initial report by a satellite television network there jolted financial markets worldwide about possible U.S. or Israeli strikes to end Iran's nuclear ambitions. Washington believes Iran is seeking an atomic bomb, an accusation denied by Tehran, which says its program is for simply generating electricity only. On the heels of all that, Iran and Syria now say they would unite against any challenges or threats to their nation's livelihoods, a move that could raise the stakes in an ongoing international drama involving both countries. The Iranian vice president, after meeting with the Syrian prime minister, told reporters that we are ready to help Syria on all grounds to confront threats. Just connect the dots. You can see a picture unfolding here. The Agriculture Department allowed Canada to send 42,000 pounds of questionable meat into the United States despite restrictions in place since that discovery of mad cow disease in Canada. The investigation resulted from a federal judge's ruling, which occurred last April, preventing the department from expanding Canadian beef imports. The agency's inspector general faulted agriculture officials for allowing more kinds of Canadian meat products into the United States before the judge's ruling. Mad cow disease, the common name for BSE, is thought to pose less of a risk to younger animals, they say. But a form of BSE, the CJD disease, can infect humans who eat contaminated meat. The Kyoto Accord, which aims to curb the air pollution that some say is blamed on global warming, has come into force 7 years after it was agreed on. The accord requires countries to cut emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. Some 141 countries, accounting for 55% of greenhouse gas emissions, have ratified the treaty. The U.S. has not signed up on the treaty, and also large developing countries, including India, China, Brazil, are not required to meet specific targets for now. A supermarket chain in Hungary has fired dozens of shop assistants for stealing, all on the advice of a clairvoyant. Angry trade unionists here are demanding that the staff be reinstated And they say that their German bosses of the chain store only acted to cut staff numbers. But according to the Hungarian Trades Union Federation, managers at a store took the personnel files of employees to a clairvoyant and then fired more than two dozen that she identified as thieves. Two skulls, originally found in 1967, have now been shown to be about 195,000 years old, making them the oldest modern human remains known to science. The age estimate comes from a redating of Ethiopian rock layers close to those that yielded the remarkable fossils. The skulls, known as Oma 1 and 2, push back the known presence of Homo sapiens in Africa by 40,000 years. You know, all they have to do is read Zechariah Sitchin's book, The 12th Planet, and they'll realize that if you can add a couple more hundred thousands of years, that they'll know exactly when those beings may have come to this planet. Here's a story that Richard C. Hoagland has been reporting on this program for some time. A leading European space agency scientist says he has found a gas in the Martian atmosphere that he believes can only be explained by the presence of life. But the few researchers who have been privy to the facts say, wait a minute now, conclusion there is premature. Vittorio Formisano of the Institute of Physics and Interplanetary Science in Rome, that's the person that Richard's been telling us about, will be speaking next week at the first conference dedicated to the results from the Mars Express spacecraft. The craft has been orbiting the red planet since December 2003. Project scientists for the Mars Express say we have allocated one full hour of debate. It could be a lively discussion. But the top story tonight, a pair of NASA scientists have told a group of space officials at a very private meeting in Washington, D.C., that they have found strong evidence that life may exist right now on Mars, hidden away in caves and sustained by pockets of water. The scientists, Carol Stoker and Larry Limke of NASA's Ames Research Center, told the group that they have submitted their findings to the journal Nature for publication in May, and their paper currently is being peer-reviewed. What Stoker and Limke have found, according to several attendees of the private meeting, is not direct proof of life on Mars, but methane signatures and other signs of possible biological activity remarkably similar to those recently discovered in caves here on Earth. A long time ago, in a not-too-far-off place, a person by the name of Richard C. Hoagland talked about life on Mars. And it's about time, I think, he's going to be vindicated. In a moment, Richard C. Hoagland. Well, welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, and no need for a lengthy introduction here. Richard C. Hoagland from EnterpriseMission.com. Is it time for you to tell the world, I told you so?
Well, you know, in all fairness, there's an awful lot of us that have been talking about this for many, many years, and Carol Stoker is a friend of mine. She used to be part of, and this is incredibly ironic given her model, what we used to call the Mars Underground, back in the 1980s when NASA was not ever deigning to even think about going back to Mars after the 1976 Viking mission. A bunch of NASA radicals, basically grad students in various universities around the country, got together and basically forced NASA to look at Mars again. And Carol Stoker was one of them. There was Penelope Boston. There was Chris McKay, who's been seen on tons of TV documentaries and Discovery and all that. Anyway, these guys and gals now are coming into their own because they kind of held the flame high and kept the hope burning brightly that there was really something there to go for. And the new missions, Mars Surveyor and, Mars Observer before that briefly, and Mars Express have now shown us tremendous indications that there is something there. And it's only a matter of time, George, until we get to the good stuff, which is not microbes, but men and women building things that we are seeing in ruins.
You know what? I don't think anybody at this point can doubt what you've said anymore. And you know, you pointed out during the rover missions a year ago on this program with me, fossils that were there.
Yep.
And some people scoffed at you. Other people agreed with you. And sure enough, they're showing all over websites now, space.com and places like that, evidence, pictures, saying, what do you think?
Well, there was a big story on MSNBC just this week bringing back one of the fossils that we pointed out and saying it may actually have cousins or maybe other things that look very similar. What I see this, George, is a politically managed event. We have gone from...
As you predicted.
A cold, desiccated place where, in the words of Elton John, not the kind of place to raise your kids. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
That great song he wrote. Oh, what a great song. Rocket Man, for those folks that don't know what we're talking about. To a place now that, well, maybe it had a warm, wet climate in the past, but certainly not now. To a place where, well, maybe there were oceans, but not now, sometime in the past. And little by little, kind of like the old salami technique, they've been slicing this thing thinner and thinner and thinner, and all of the projections of a warm, wet Mars and wonderful oceans and a place where life could flourish, but always in the past. Now today, you have two competing groups. You got a NASA group, you know, Carol and her friend, and then you got our old friend, you know, Vittorio Formisano from Italy, and they're both vying within the same, you know, news cycle for the claim, we've got life on Mars now.
Yes, exactly. Both of them. Two different camps.
Said, this is a time-release aspirin scenario, and you watch, we're going to go from, you know, deserts to water to life to the good stuff someday.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what Carol Stoker, Larry Limke talked to scientists about in a private meeting and what former scientists
would say. Don't you like the fact they talk about this private meeting and no one gives it a name?
I know that. I know that's incredible. Well, you know, when you... You knew about this way before anybody, and when you contacted me this morning and said, oh, George, and I I read your message, and I went, oh, my, we're going to have to do something on this one. I mean,
well,
this is a dramatic story.
Last September when we had Paolo on, Paola Harris, my good friend in Rome, and she was following, you know, poor Masano from meeting to meeting and phone call to phone call, trying to get him to get pregnant. That's a pun, guys. You know, we said then, that was last fall, that it's going to probably be in the spring. And sure and behold, it's just before spring. We're what, about a month away from the equinox? And lo and behold, we now have two groups, a NASA group and an ESA group, competing to be the first to get recognized that there is current life, little guys living under the ground on Mars. Gosh, who would ever have thought?
I'm going to read a paragraph here to you. Carol Stoker and other researchers have long theorized that the Martian subsurface could harbor biological organisms that have developed unusual strategies for existing in extreme environments. That suspicion led Stoker and a team of U.S. and Spanish researchers in 2003 to southwestern Spain to search for subsurface life near the Rio Tinto River, so-called because of its reddish tint, the product of iron being dissolved in its highly acidic water. It is much like what they think might have been out there on Mars. And so what they're doing is I guess they have picked up on this, the methane, and now they're theorizing there could be lots of organisms down there.
Well, you see, these are two sides of the same story, George. Both Carol and her friend and Formisano are saying the same thing.
Yes, they are.
They're both looking at the same data, and they're saying the same thing. Now, Formisano, to take him first, he's going to give this paper on formaldehyde next week, which is a hydrocarbon chemical that is produced by the breakdown of methane. So what he's saying is he's seeing so much formaldehyde in his PFS data from Mars Express, something like 170 parts per million, I believe, and it can only come from the dissociation chemical, not sunlight activity, but chemical breakdown of methane, and much, much more methane than has been hitherto kind of, you know, agreed to be on Mars. So he says it's got to be produced by life. That much methane cannot come from any other source than life. What he wouldn't tell Paola a few months ago, now he's telling the world. Now we come back across the pond, the Atlantic Ocean, to Washington, to this secret meeting. Don't you like it that there was a secret meeting, George?
That you know about.
aren't we paying for this stuff? This
you would
research?
Think so, yeah.
It's all NASA money. Why was it a secret meeting on Sunday before the news breaks, you know, midweek? By the way, Space.com, which broke the story, said they tried to get hold of Carol, and she's not answering her phone.
No comments, no response. They can't get her.
Does that make any sense?
No, not at all.
I mean, this almost looks like one of those trial balloons where you're conveniently out of town when the balloon goes up. Just in case it doesn't fly,
well,
you're not
going to
be,
And it looks like Formosano was trying to beat them at the punch by making his statement real quickly.
A week before his papers to be given next week. Well, look, you and I have both said on the show many times that the only way we're going to get a space program back is if we get good, healthy competition. Let's hear it for competition, an American concept, right? Finally, when we get various people competing for ego, which is basically the name on the history books that say so-and-so discovered life on Mars, it looks like we're finally at the point where we're almost pregnant, and they're both looking at the same data. Now, what's that data? It's the data that a guy at Goddard, the Goddard Space Flight Center, which is one of NASA's centers, named Michael Mumma, reported last fall at one of the major science meetings regarding his discovery from Earth using big telescopes and spectroscopes from this planet of an extraordinary amount of methane. Remember back last spring, we were talking about the spacecraft seeing, you know, like 10, 11 parts per billion?
Yeah.
And then Mumma comes up with his announcement a few months later that he had seen with the telescopes in Hawaii and in South America 250 billion parts per billion, which is, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of times more only in a few months. Now, the only way you can explain that, George, is if we're looking at seasonal activity and what happens in spring. Things grow, right?
That's right.
Whether it's plant life or microbes, methanogens, things that spit out methane, they grow in the spring and they go into hibernation in the winter. Well, it was Martian spring last Earth fall in the Northern Hemisphere. So Michael Mumma reports all this methane, and then Carol and her friend, whose name I really need to pronounce, Larry Lemke. Of NASA's Ames Research Center, they did this research. They're in Spain looking at very similar conditions that they posit for Mars, and lo and behold, they say based on the methane. Remember, they haven't seen a microbe yet. Nobody's got a microscope on Mars looking at microbes. It's all inferred, but it's inferred on very good data based on what seems to happen here. You get rises and falls in methane production. It means you got rises and falls in colonies of organisms producing it. Now, of course, the real news is going to be if one of these guys admits that maybe the green stuff we're seeing on the surface, not underground, not hidden, not microbes, but big stuff, like enough to be a colony of algae, that could be life on Mars.
Maybe even small trees. Is that possible?
Maybe even small trees like Arthur's bushes.
Yeah.
In other words, what I'm thinking is that this is the beginning of getting pregnant, to use the metaphor again.
But this is not disclosure, is it?
Not yet.
No.
Not yet. What it will be when it's official is you'll have whoever the head of NASA is going to be. Hint, hint.
Could be you.
Yes.
Breaking, by the way, part of our deal, if you get this post because of our efforts, is you need to break the stories on Coast to Coast first.
Absolutely.
I don't want any news conferences. I want story first.
Okay. Well, there might be conflict of interest in the law that I'm not aware of, but
well, you'll check into
that. We'll think of something.
Yeah, we don't want you kicked out as soon as you're in.
Yes. Anyway, the point is the NASA administrator is going to have to sit down and do a press conference and basically say, okay, there is, by all scientific agreement, life on Mars. That's when we are officially in disclosure. But we're getting really close, George, incredibly close. And I, again, I'm very heartened that we're having this competition between the NASA team and the ESA team. And our old friend Formosano is raising his head and saying, wait a minute, what about my stuff? I said it last year, formaldehyde.
That's exactly right. And this, what they're talking about now, is it more dramatic than what happened years ago when they talked about the Martian meteorite and the organism that was on it?
Well, because the Martian meteorite was dead. You know, it was dead, Jim. It wasn't threatening. It was in a rock. It was millions of years old. It was fossilized. It was safely removed in time. This is live little guys
that
on Mars.
That haven't died off yet.
That are still there. Now, of course, our model, which is the one that I keep bringing up, which is the tidal model, which is that Mars once had this incredible flourishing biosphere that it was a moon orbiting a big planet that blew up,
courtesy
of Tom Van Flander and his ideas, and that used to have two huge oceans. Well, isn't it interesting that we've landed both rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, on the edges of both of those oceans, those ancient oceans we're proposing on opposite sides of Mars, and that's where one of these minerals, jarosite, that is reported in the space.com story for the Rio Tinto in Spain as an acid kind of bearing river that harbors these microorganisms, is very similar to the chemistry that the rovers have bequeathed to us from this year-long odyssey across the Martian desert.
I think they knew why they were sending the rovers where they did. Don't you?
A definite plan.
Richard, stay with us. I want to talk to you next about the scenario of what Mars really looked like billions of years ago. And honestly, we need to talk about Cydonia. It's been a while, and I want you to refresh a lot of us about your theories about that. We'll be back in a moment with Richard C. Hoagland, who said a long time ago that Mars was once teeming with life, and that it probably still is.
If you did, I don't understand. It's just my job, 5 days a week. A rocket man. Streets full of people. Alone. Roads full of houses, never home. Church full of singing, out of tune. Everyone's gone to the moon. Eyes full of sorrow. Hands full of money, all in debt. Sun coming out in the middle of June. Everyone's gone to the moon.
From the City of Angels, Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
The top of the hour, our guest will be Charles R. Smith. Lots happening in the world of robotics. We're going to bring him in to talk about some of this. The cyber wars ahead. Invisible aircraft. Can you believe it? Well, Charles R. Smith, he'll have some answers for us. After Dark newsletter, you can get that by calling 1-888-727-5505, 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online at coasttocoastam.com. Only a few weeks left. You will get the free CD, Art Bell's interview on Mel's Hole, when you renew and subscribe. But that's it for this CD. So take advantage of it. These collector item CDs are not reproduced once we are done with these promotions. So take advantage. 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Richard, are you standing, many chance, Mr. Hoagland?
Say again?
Are you standing?
No.
Well, I want you to stand and take a bow, because you indeed, you deserve it. You know, you. How many years have you been at this, specifically Mars?
20.
20 years. 20 years you've come up with theories. You know, we know about being the consultant to CBS and Cronkite, but your theories, and I told you a long time ago, I strangely enough bought one of your videos of Cydonia years ago, before I even knew you, because I was just fascinated with that. I mean, you stuck your neck out way before anybody even made these theories. You know what? And you didn't have to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to come up with the same theories that they're coming up with now.
Well, you looked at old data. Wait. As Newton said, if I have seen farther, it's because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. And without the NASA data, we wouldn't have theories. I agree with that.
But you interpreted this better than they did, or they kept it quiet.
Unfortunately, I think it's the second. I think there is a lack of courage in the scientific academic community where people are so afraid. You know, the political correctness has basically done in the idea of free intellectual inquiry, and so everyone is afraid to stick their neck out. Well, thank God my mom and dad raised me right, and I'm not afraid to stick my neck out. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But in this case, I don't think we're wrong.
Let's paint a picture for a moment, and then I want to talk with you about Cydonia. Take some of the things that Tom Van Flandern has provided, and give us a scenario. How many billions of years are we talking about? Is this the infancy of the solar system, 4.5 billion years ago? Paint us a picture of Mars. As you say, it was a moon of another planetary object. Where is it? What happened? And then tell us what Mars was like before all this happened.
There is, in the NASA data, a stunning look at an alternative history for not just the human species, but the solar system. And what folks like me, what our job is, I believe, is to lay out the alternatives. Because if we don't, nobody else is going to. We've just posted part three of our Iapetus series tonight on the website.
Excellent.
Right under the God, Man, and E.T. banner. If you go to enterprisemission.com and you scroll a little way down right under God, Man, and E.T., you'll see a moon with a view, fascinating anomalies on Saturn's moon Iapetus. Part three is up tonight. And it's got lots of additional surprises. Now, my critics always yell at me for speculating. Well, boys and girls, science is speculation. That's the only way we ever advance the field. The science comes in when you take the data and the speculations, put them together, shake well, and come out with predictions that then you will look for new data to support the prediction. So we made a bunch of predictions based on NASA data many years ago, and I and people like Tom Van Flandern and others are looking more and more like we're the guys that are right.
You got the instincts of a cat. Instincts of a cat, I'll tell you that.
What you look at when you look at the solar system, the way Tom looked at it, is you see a system in change. You see a sun, a star, surrounded by nine planets and some junk, lots of junk, comets, asteroids. And Tom raised the question years ago, where did the junk come from? And his conclusion, based on his years as an expert of celestial mechanics, was explosions, cosmic explosions. Planets are not immortal. They don't live forever. They blow up. And he cited in all these papers and books and whatever, umpteen reams of evidence indicating that the asteroids and the comets came from the explosion of several planets that are no longer with us that used to be part of the nine, more than the nine.
Some scientists say a planet that never formed. Tom believes it already was.
Exactly.
It blew up. Okay.
Yep. Now, as part of his model, he said a few years ago that Mars was a moon orbiting one of those planets that is no longer with us because one day it blew up. And when Tom and I met back at a DPS meeting, which is a division of planetary sciences meeting in Pittsburgh years and years and years ago, God, this was decades ago, back when Carl and I were trying to keep Voyager alive,
yep.
We met over lunch, and I then was not the rabble-rouser that I am now. I was more kind of like a mainstream guy back then.
You were?
Yes, I actually had friends in NASA.
You mean you actually wore a tie instead of that thing you wear at these conferences?
Right. Well, I'm New Mexico. Come on, that's the hallmark of New Mexico. Anyway, it's called a bolo, by the way.
Okay.
Anyway, so Tom and I sat down to lunch, and we had this really cool conversation. We kind of realized, even though I wasn't the rebel that I am now, that we were kindred spirits under the skin. And years and years and years later, after Cydonia, after we'd found the artifacts of Cydonia, after we had posited based on new NASA evidence that there's lots of other stuff all over Mars built by somebody incredibly intelligent, high-tech stuff, not low-tech stuff, not microbes, but really cool stuff. One day I started looking at some of the new data coming in from Mars Odyssey and Mars Surveyor, and I realized I had the smoking gun to prove Tom's model. which was there appeared to be signatures on Mars indicating two ancient tidal oceans. Now, the key word in that is tidal, because the only way you can get tides is if you have one body with liquid on it sloshing around, orbiting another body, and the gravity between them will produce tides on the body with the liquid.
Okay, and did Mars, as this moon of this object,
yep,
before it blew up,
yep,
did it? It had its ocean, it had
its
atmosphere,
oceans,
it had
two of them.
It had its life. What
it
do you
had
think?
A whole flourish. If we're right, it had a whole flourishing biosphere, and if we're right about the numbers, and you can go to enterprisemission.com and scroll about halfway down the page, and you will see various links to the Mars tidal model. Look for those three words, Mars tidal model. Click on that, and you can read a very complicated paper, which, by the way, I found is on Google's scholarly search for scientific papers on the web. We're actually in the scientific literature with
this.
Good
for you.
I found this out yesterday doing a search for something else. Lo and behold, there I was.
Well, the planet that blew up, what do you think it looked like?
I mean, it was bigger.
Okay.
It was more massive.
Not like Jupiter?
Smaller than Jupiter, but bigger than a bread box.
All right.
Okay? It was probably bigger than Mars, probably more like Earth, maybe a couple, three Earth masses. And for whatever reason, it blew up. Tom, when you ask him, well, why did it blow up, Tom, he doesn't really have a good answer. My answer is it blew up because of the hyperdimensional physics, which is a whole other program we don't have time to get into tonight. But yes, that's what
okay,
causes
but in so up. In so doing, it blows up.
And all this shrapnel gets sprayed all over Mars right next door.
And destroys Mars.
And destroys Mars and obliterates half of Mars. The oceans disappear into space. The rest of it freezes, goes underground. The atmosphere is blown away. It is definitely not the kind of place to ever raise your kids ever again.
Does this explosion of this planet, does it occur in an instant, or is it coming along over millions of years?
No, hours. It's an explosion. Think of the most incredible special effects explosion, you know, Tatooine in Star Wars, and magnify it by 100,000 times. I mean, a planet blowing up in your own backyard is something to see. It's not something to live through, but it's something to see.
So if there were inhabitants on Mars, they had no chance.
They were toast. Now, if they were as advanced as the ruins appear to make it out that they were, they had colonies all over the solar system. That's why we're finding things up to and including this new moon of Saturn that we've just looked at close up for the first time on New Year's Eve, called Iapetus, that may have been part of the far-flung solar system civilization prior to the Mars catastrophe.
I think you're a guest Wednesday, are you not?
Lisa says it looks like we're looking at our big show on this on Wednesday.
All right, and that would include, I think, maybe David Greenspoon.
We're
with
hoping
you?
David Greenspoon will join us.
All
because
right.
I would love to have a serious conversation about a range of things, data-oriented, where NASA can look at their own data and see the evidence. I mean, Fred Hoyle said there was no such thing as an outrageous hypothesis. Somehow we have gotten to the position where if you advance an idea that's a little bit beyond everybody else's, people look at you as if you're nuts.
Now, hold on, though. You were saying that unless they were advanced, so
yes,
you were going somewhere then.
If they were not advanced on Mars, they would have all died.
All right.
But the fact is that it looks like some of them came here.
I mean, how much? Yeah, but they didn't have much notice, or were they already here?
They're all over the solar system. It's kind of like the tsunami.
So they didn't have a home to go back to.
That's right. Think of all those people, you know, victims of the tsunami who were away from home, who were visiting in Sumatra or visiting in Sri Lanka. Their home was, you know, Sweden or Finland or wherever, you know, else they came from, but they were vacationing. So let's assume that Mars was done in, but that meant there was a lot of other elements of the civilization in other places that had to go somewhere because they couldn't go home because home no longer existed, at least in the form that they knew it.
Well, how fortunate then to have a planetary object like Earth with a good atmosphere where they could just plop down here.
And that whole history is something that, again, with science we can figure out step by step by step what happened, particularly if we get to Mars and we find the libraries. Because with a high-tech civilization, you've got libraries. You have probably libraries of this event on the moon, our own moon. Libraries on little moons, like maybe the moons of Mars have repositories. There's all kinds of stuff out there once we know what we're looking for and we've developed the technology to find it. The bottom line is that when Mars was destroyed, it was not totally destroyed. I mean, the planet's obviously still there, right?
Well, obviously it wasn't that close to its planet, or it really would have been gone.
Well, it was, I mean, if you look at the numbers, it was so horrendous that there's no way in a couple of minutes I can describe how horrendous. The point is that it destroyed the environment. It did not destroy the world. It left Mars as a place.
But it torched it? Did it torch Mars?
Well, one half of it, the side that was facing the planet blew up,
okay,
which was the southern hemisphere.
Okay.
It plastered it with 20 miles of junk, all those craters, wall-to-wall craters. That's why we're seeing evidence of incredible incineration all over Mars. That's why you've got, you know, oxide, because the atmosphere that used to have oxygen was toast and crisped in an instant. So now you had oxides of sand and iron, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, why can't the mainstream scientists, Richard, say what you've been saying and what Van Flandern's been saying? Why can't they say, look, we think there was another major object in the solar system. We think it blew up and affected Mars. Instead, they say, we don't know what happened to the atmosphere. We don't know why the oceans dried up.
It has to do with a lack of imagination and a lack of courage. Someday, hopefully before you end your tenure on December 22nd, 2012, they will come to this conclusion, because the data is inexorably driving us closer and closer and closer, as you'll see next week with the Iapetus data and the new discussions around that. Back to Cydonia, back to Mars. When Mars was destroyed and whoever lived there had to go somewhere else, those that were not caught in this catastrophe, they came here.
That's or maybe they were already in craft outside of the planet, right?
Or outposts or colonies or even on Earth, I mean.
Maybe on the moon, who knows?
Exactly. Right. Think of a solar system-wide confederation with colonies and outposts everywhere that one wants to hang out.
So you believe Mars may have been way more advanced than Earth?
I think human species came from Mars, yes. And what we see on Earth is a derivative genetics, a derivative society, derivative cultures, derivative species from what was tinkered with from Mars, yes.
And that includes maybe Atlantis?
Of course.
The pyramids
Absolutely.
On Egypt? Okay.
All that knowledge base, all that hidden history, and that again is more shows.
So when Edgar Cayce said, in two spots on this planet, at the base of the foot of the Sphinx and somewhere in South America, that you will find Hall of Records, he might have been alluding then to the fact that Martians indeed came here.
He might have been, and we will someday find out if we just continue to open doors and ask questions. But back to Mars. It's very hard, George, to destroy a planet totally. And our scenario, based on the tidal model, is that no matter how horrendous and catastrophic this event was, it did not destroy Mars totally. It left something, a biosphere in terrible condition, but a biosphere nonetheless. And what's happened in the 65 million years since this event, notice that date, 65 million years, when the dinosaurs...
Which sounds like then maybe a piece of that planet hit us.
Lots of pieces.
Uh-huh.
Lots of pieces.
Okay.
In fact, well, that's another whole discussion.
My God.
But what happened on Mars is that the remnants of this biosphere shattered in pieces, torched, atmosphere gone. Whatever survived evolved to survive and flourish in the new Mars, the new environment, the Mars we see today. So when scientists now, people at NASA and people at ESA, talk about a few little meek microorganisms, I think they're missing a huge possibility, which is that whatever survived this awful night of catastrophe and then evolved separately for 65 million years is going to be incredibly tough, incredibly tenacious, incredibly fitted to the current environment, and I think there will be stunning biological surprises on the current Mars, having evolved from that catastrophe which doomed the old Mars that we never knew.
I think so, too, because even if 65 million years ago, if that timetable is correct, you don't have small little organisms on Mars right now. You've got maybe some animals or something.
Well, look how ecosystems are laid out, you know, with ecological niches and species feeding off each other and a whole ecosystem, a whole interdependent system. If you were to wipe out life on Earth, almost total, what would replace it would be new guys filling those niches, interrelating with each other, living off each other in an interdependent ecosystem, which is the definition of ecology. So I think we're going to see not just a few little microbes in tiny little pools underground like Carol is positing, but something much more audacious, something much more interesting, something that might even include, you know, Carl's, you know, Martian elephants. When Viking landed, he made sure the cameras were set up in a way that they could see overnight if there were any footprints left by something coming, sniffing around the Vikings that had landed. Carl had imagination. It's a shame Carl is not with us, because we need people like Carl, like Carol, who are not afraid to venture beyond the rest of the pack and say, this might actually be what is occurring.
Well, and I've got to tell you, if and when we do get astronauts on that planet, they better be careful, because who knows then if these critters aren't pretty darn mean, huh?
It's like landing in Watts. You do not want to go into a very dangerous environment thinking that nobody is around and they're not fit to survive.
Well, that's true. They got to be careful. Well, Richard, one, I'm looking forward to Wednesday.
Oh, we're going to have such fun.
And again, I am so proud of the fact that after all these years of listening to you with Art when I was a kid, and that's a joke. Do you get that?
Yes, George, I got that.
Okay.
We're the same age, everybody.
But really, listening to you and listening to your theories, listening to your stories, keeping us up at night, making us go, oh my, or wow, and then all of a sudden start to really see science catch up with the things that you interpreted with. And I'm impressed, I got to tell you.
Thank you, George.
I really appreciate it. Say that to a lot of people.
It means a lot.
So enterprisemission.com, you've got the part three
of Iapetus is up there. Read it and have fun. There are surprises galore, and I'm working on part four now.
All right, get it ready for Wednesday.
Thank you.
All right, Richard, you take care.
You too.
Isn't that something that is so cool to be able to talk to him and have him react to what these mainstream scientists are now saying? Here's the headline: signs of current life on Mars, researchers claim. Methane signatures seen hinting at possibilities underground. My, aren't we living in some incredible times right now? For good or for bad, they are incredible times. And part of the incredible times continues with our guest Charles R. Smith, as we're going to bring him in, and you're going to see what technology is really beginning to do to this planet. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
Get it in writing with the After Dark newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505.